Today's Teisho will be on case 50 in the Blue Cliff record, the Blue Rock collection, the Pi Yen Nu. Case 50 is entitled Umon's Particle After Particle Samadhi. Ango's introduction, transcending all ranks, rising above all expedients, spirit corresponding to spirit, words answering words. Unless he has undergone the great emancipation and attained the great use of it, how could he rank with the Buddhas and be a faultless exponent of the teachings? Now tell me, who can be so direct and adaptable to all occasions and have the free command of transcendent words? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Umon, what is particle after particle's samadhi? Umon said, rice in the bowl, water in the pail. Setra's verse, rice in the bowl, water in the pail. Even the most talkative can add nothing. The north and south stars do not change places. Heaven-touching waves rise on land. If you doubt, if you hesitate, though heir to millions, trouserless. Thank you so much for coming to practice this morning. The sitting in the Zendo was really very deep. You know, it's important to practice on your own as often as you can. Ideally, people should practice every day. Individual practice is really important. You know, getting up in the morning and making some time to sit, if that's possible in your schedule, it's a wonderful way to live your life. You know, you get up in the morning, maybe you have a cup of tea, go to the bathroom, sit down on the cushion. You know, the mind is calm when you wake up. You watch the breath, you hear the sounds of the birds outside. You know, it's a wonderful way to start your day. You get off the cushion maybe half an hour later or 45 minutes later, and you go off to your work, and you probably have a kind of calm, kind of a balance that you wouldn't otherwise have if you just got up and you surf the web, and you know, maybe you listen to the radio. It's not the same thing. That, you know, when you watch your breath and you begin to calm the mind, you begin to enter this alternate state of consciousness, which is we call samadhi. And in that state, the barrier between yourself and the world is less rigid and thick, and we begin to experience our connectedness to things, sometimes in very subtle ways, but you know, we get off the cushion and it's often the case that we feel better than when we sat down. Even if somebody asked you, how do you feel better, you might not be able to say. You know, you might not be able to say, but somehow you do feel better. That's not an illusion. It might not be clear at first why you feel better, but part of it is that you're opening yourself up to the world around you. And when that happens, it's like a fish meeting the ocean. You know, it's very beautiful to be suddenly at home in the world. When we practice together like this, I think it's quite special also. Even though individual practice is crucial, you know, this kind of practice is really a great gift. You know, coming together to practice like this, people with good intentions, all concentrating, have a kind of collective energy. I often find that I can reach the deepest samadhi when I'm sitting with other people. Again, it might not be obvious why, but I think there are many subtle psychological reasons why collective practice is so powerful, so enabling. If you practice at home, you don't need to have an altar, you don't need to have a candle, you don't need anything, really. You can just sit down and practice. But if you have a little candle and you make a little altar and you light a little incense, you may actually find that in some ways it deepens the experience. You know, somehow doing something like a little ritual like that can actually make the experience more profound, more resonant. You know, somehow gives it a kind of depth. You know, sometimes people will even have an altar at home, and they'll have a little Buddha statue or picture of the Buddha on the altar. And all of this prepares the mind for meditation. You know, so the altar, the statue, the candle aren't necessary, but their presence, in a way, prepares the mind for entry into samadhi. And the same thing is true when people come together in this kind of collective situation. You know, it prepares the mind in a special way. You know, you're making a resolution. You come here, other people are here, all striving towards the same goal. And that collective energy makes the room into what's called a Bodhi mandala, like a mandala. In the Tibetan tradition, monks create these beautiful representations of the world, actually, or representations of the mind and the world in their unity. And so, you know, as the monks go through this elaborate ritual of laying out the mandala and filling it in with colored sand, they're actually meditating themselves. And so, you know, these are all strategies designed to deepen the experience of sitting and deepen the experience of samadhi. So something like this, what we've done today, I think is very special. People coming together and very precious. You know, it's not always possible to find people who want to do this. And when you run into such people, you should really treasure them. Really. I have a lot of friends, you know, and sometimes I'll go jogging with them, or I see them at work and we have lunch. But sometimes I'll say, you know, would you like to try sitting? And they don't want to do it, and that's fine. But I'm always on the lookout for people I can practice meditation with. There's something very special about that experience. And again, it might not be obvious at first why it's special. But if you do it for a while, it will change your life. And if you stop doing it, you might find that something's missing. Maybe not, but you might find that something's missing. So thank you for coming. Today's Teisho is a simple statement. It's this idea. A monk said to Umon. Umon is Yunmen. It's a cloud gate. A monk asked Master Cloudgate, what is particle after particle's samadhi? And this is a wonderful koan, you know, because usually we don't have particle after particle samadhi. Usually we're very distracted. You know, what happens to us is that it's very difficult to be here in the moment, moment by moment. You know, I myself get up in the morning and I do meditate, and I always feel better. I take a shower, and then I have to go to work. And while I'm taking my shower, I might be thinking about something that's going on at work. And maybe there's some tension at work. I don't know what it is about work, but there's often tension at work. There might be something going on that's troubling, or there's a problem that I don't know how to solve. Sometimes there's interpersonal things that go on at work. Some of the people who work with me don't always get along. And, you know, I can come to work sometime and I can see that there's been some kind of a conflict already, you know. So I might be thinking about this, and then, you know, all of a sudden I'll think, well, did I shampoo my hair or not, you know? And sometimes I'll shampoo my hair a second time just to make sure I shampoo my hair. If I can't really remember. It's because I'm so absorbed in my thoughts about what's coming up that I'm not present in the moment. You know, this is just a common human thing. You know, sometimes you can think back about in the past, and you could be sort of remembering something that happened to you a long time ago. And you could be so absorbed in that memory that you're not really paying attention to what's happening right now. You know. So this is a normal human condition. You know, we're not really ordinarily in the present moment, sort of unreservedly or one-pointedly. You know, and so, you know, if you could sort of watch your consciousness during the day, you'd see that you're here and somewhere else almost all the time. You know, we're here and we're anticipating the future. Maybe we're anticipating the future so much that the present disappears. Or we're nostalgic for the past, and we're so nostalgic for the past that, you know, the present disappears. This happens all the time. You know, I was earlier this year I went to Washington D.C. and there was a store I used to love to go to. It was a store that sold Chinese and Japanese art objects. It's right near DuPont. It used to be right near DuPont Circle. And every time I would go to Washington, D.C. to visit or for vacation or for work, I would go to this store, and it was like a treasure house of beautiful objects, you know, beautiful ceramics and statues. It had paintings, it was like a museum almost. And I was looking forward to it for a day, really, all day, you know. And then the next day I got up and I went to see it and it was gone, you know. And, you know, it took me a while to get over it, you know. I went in and I had a cup of coffee and, you know, if you ask me what did you do that morning, I don't really remember. You know, I was just so caught up in what I used to do at that place, how wonderful that was. I've been going there for 20 years. You know, so the past, which is really gone, you know, survived in my mind, and it became so overwhelming that I wasn't present. So I really didn't have a morning. You know, I was in the past. So you know, actually, our ordinary everyday consciousness is very much like this. And of course, it's not neutral. You know, as I'm taking my shower and I'm thinking about a conflict at work, you know, I myself might be getting more and more tense, you know, or more and more worried. You know, so I'm not just thinking about the future, I'm entering a kind of emotional state. And the same thing in the past, you know, with the experience in D.C., you know, I had a great sense of nostalgia, you know. When I discovered this shop, I was like 35 years old, you know. Now I'm in a different place in my life, and the shop is gone, and it feels, you know, feels like, oh my gosh, you know, life is slipping away. It's you know, having those kinds of thoughts, and so some of those are painful thoughts. You think, gee, you know, there's more of my life in the past now than there is in the future, probably, you know, and that can really tug at your heartstrings, and so you're not in the moment again. You know, there's an emotional. You can go around feeling like you've lost something all day, yeah? So our ordinary mental state is not usually 100% here. And so we really don't think about this, or even we're not really aware of this, because in a way our sort of everyday consciousness can be sort of like a jumble. It's sort of a jumble, you know, it's just sort of one thing after another. So you're driving down the street, and you're trying not to have an accident, and you're thinking about your job. And then, you know, you remember something from your childhood, and you feel emotion like nostalgia. And then you think about the boss and you feel anxious, and then you're back to the road. Somebody cuts you off. Maybe you're annoyed, maybe you're angry. You know, then you think about your childhood. You know, this is a sort of ordinary consciousness. When we do meditation, you know, when we do zazen, we're cultivating a kind of one-pointed attention on the present moment, the present moment. So, you know, when we're beginners, and on Friday night, we had a new person, a woman who came and had maybe done some meditation before, but nothing formally. And I taught her, you know, let's watch our breath, watch each out breath, and just try to focus on the out breath. And, you know, for a beginner, this is quite, you know, this seems so easy, right? But actually so difficult. You watch the first out breath, you watch the second out breath, you watch the third out breath, and then you're 20 years in the past, or you're thinking about the future, or you're replaying the television show you saw three nights ago in your head, you know. So you know, we keep bringing the mind back to the present, back to the present. And it's a struggle, right? We have a capacity to live in our imaginations, you know. We have this very, very powerful imagination. And we can actually become so absorbed in our mental movie or our inner theater that the world around us absolutely disappears. And you know, you can be so absorbed in your projections or your memories that you can be unaware of the time, you can be unaware of, you know, did I shampoo my hair or not, you know. So, you know, Zen practice involves a kind of, you could think of it as a kind of therapy or medicine, which is to keep bringing the mind back to the present moment. And we watch the first breath, we watch the second breath, we watch the third breath. And, you know, this has a profound effect over time. You know, if you come into meditation and you're tense, you know, maybe something happened to you during the day that's upsetting you, you can't get rid of it. You know, it keeps, those loops keep playing, those tapes keep playing in your head. And, you know, it's a real struggle, can be a real struggle to sit. So you keep bringing the mind back to the present moment, and you bring it back, and it keeps getting caught up in those loops again. Even if you don't manage, finally, to get free from the loops, when the bell rings and you get up at the end of the evening, you're probably still much better off than when you sat down. You're probably a little calmer. You probably feel a little more centered or grounded. And this is really wonderful. This is really therapeutic. So, you know, meditation in our tradition is all about trying to pull the mind back to the present moment, back to the present moment when it wanders off into the past or into imaginary projections of the future. You keep coming back to the moment, and little by little, you know, you become more relaxed, and eventually, you know, you get to a place where you are, you're not just relaxed, but you're in a kind of alternate state of consciousness. I talked about this a little bit last time, you know. Ordinary consciousness is crisp and clear, and it feels very precise, but when you are watching the breath, you're going to slip into a state of mind which is not so crisp and clear. It's a little bit fuzzier or a little bit less well-defined. It's not sleep and it's not waking. And when you're in that state, you're actually very receptive. It's like a kind of very receptive condition. You know, just after you get up, before you really get caught up in your mental routines, you're in a state of mind which is a little bit blank. But it's very open, you know. So this is a little bit like that, you know. You're in this very open state, and you're watching the breath, and you keep bringing your attention back to the breath, back to the breath, back to the breath, and it not just calms you, but you begin to stop focusing so obsessively on your thoughts, and you begin to feel yourself eventually. This is a little difficult, but eventually there's going to be moments where you feel your consciousness more or less fusing with your breath. Your consciousness is beginning to sort of merge with your breath. You know, Zen, the word Zen, it comes from his Japanese pronunciation of the Chinese word Chan. Chan is a Mandarin word for a Sanskrit word, which is jhana. So you can see jhana, chan, zen. So sound is similar. When people try to translate jhana, they translate it as meditation. But all the schools of Buddhist meditation are meditation schools. You know, jhana really means absorption or fusion. So, you know, when we're meditating on the breath, at first the breath seems very distant, very remote. And then eventually, you know, if you keep moving away from your thoughts back to the breath, you get to a place where the breath feels much more present. It's much more at the front of your consciousness. And eventually, you may be able to merge yourself with your breath, to become, we say in Zen, become one with the breath. Become one with the breath. Sometimes we become one with other things. We have this amazing capacity to become unified with the object of our attention. So sometimes, about 3 weeks ago, we finished our Friday night meditation and we walked outside and the campus was completely deserted and the grass had just been cut and it was very still and actually rather cool. And as we walked out of the building to the right, there was a full moon hanging in the sky, in a cloudless sky. You know, and I just turned and I looked at that moon, and I'm sure many people did that night. And when I looked at that moon, there wasn't a thought in my head. You know, it was just moon. And my whole consciousness was moon. You know, this is one-pointed absorption into the object of attention. You know, you might be taking a walk. And you turn around and you see a tree with the leaves shimmering in the wind. And for a moment, there's no thought in your head. Your whole consciousness is just tree. It's 100% tree. You're not thinking, I see the tree. You're just fused with the tree. Well, this state of absorption or fusion can happen on the cushion too, where we just totally become fused with the breath. As the breath is going out, we become one with the breath. See, if you do this, you'll notice something a little unusual. At first, it might seem trivial, but ultimately very important. As you follow the breath out, and you keep doing this repetitively, as you become one with the breath, at the end of the breath, your mind is going to be very still. At the end of the breath, there's a kind of stillness or emptiness. Yeah. And so you follow the breath out, and it's very subtle, very difficult to discern. But if you practice, you're going to notice that when you get to the end of the breath, there's just this interval which is quite still. And this is very important. We call this place U, or Mu. It's U, we say U Shin. In Sanskrit, this is called shunyata, zeroness, emptiness. So if you follow the breath, you'll get to this place. It might just be like that, but eventually that emptiness becomes broader and vaster. You just keep returning to that place. You know, this is a very advanced state of concentration that I'm describing. Ordinary sits don't always take you to this place. Ordinary sits are sitting down, thinking about work, you know, watching the breath, thinking about work, watching the breath, having some fantasies of some kind, coming back to the breath, thinking about dinner, bell rings. Okay, that's a typical sit. sometimes when we sit in a very concentrated way and we're really in the groove, you know, we can get to these more focused states, especially at Sesshin. You know, so basically you're watching the breath, and you get to this empty space. Now, you know, if you're in this state of mind, it's a very, very important state of mind. This is the most foundational kind of concentration. So, you know, when you're watching the breath like this, you watch the breath, and then you get to the emptiness. And then you come back and you watch the breath, and you get to the emptiness. And you come back and watch the breath, and you get to the emptiness. This state of mind is very hard to achieve, but it's very important. You know, you're experiencing each moment as it is, just as it is. Actually, if you really meditate very deeply and you're really in the groove, you'll notice that, you know, consciousness itself is not continuous. See, we normally think of consciousness as a stream without any interruptions. We normally think of consciousness as just ongoing. And if you don't look carefully at your mind, it appears to be the case. That appears to be the case. So we have thoughts, we have impressions, sense impressions. So, you know, you're thinking, you're eating as you think, you cross the street, you hear horn honking, you feel the heat, you think about your job, you think about your wife or your husband, you know, you wonder if you try to remember if you've paid all the bills. You know, this is a normal consciousness. So it just seems to go on and on. But actually, that's a very unrefined understanding of your mental processing. You know, if you really slow down, if you sit down on the cushion and you balance the body and you let the body become settled, the mind will become settled. And when the mind becomes settled, you'll notice that consciousness is not continuous. It's not continuous. It's constant. There's a moment of awareness, and then there's a little blank space. And there's a moment of awareness and a little blank space. If you keep practicing meditation, this will be very, very obvious. So, you know, sometimes you go to a movie. This probably doesn't happen so much anymore, but in the old days, when I was growing up, we used to go to a theater on a military base where my father used to work. And they had an old projector, and every Saturday night there was a free movie. You could go to the base theater and see a free movie. And we would go see, like, James Bond, the first James Bond movie, you know, Around the World in 80 Days, all these old movies that I'm sure you've never seen. You know, free movie, what could be more wonderful? But the projector was an old projector. You know, every once in a while it would act up. So you'd be watching, you know, Sean Connery, James Bond, would be fighting and karate chopping somebody. And then all of a sudden, the images would get jerky. And then the images would start to slow down. And instead of seeing a continuous motion, you'd see frame, 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 frame. You know what I mean? So there'd be it would be like the images on the screen, on the big movie screen, would start blinking. It would start blinking, and you'd see these white spaces between the images. And then, of course, the projector would stop, and there'd be a blank screen. Well, you know, actually, reality is like that. If you're in deep samadhi, deep concentration, you know, you realize that our perception of the world is not continuous. It's like a flash, blank, flash, blank. Flash, blank, or image, blank, image, blank, image, blank. So consciousness doesn't really function the way we think. It's actually punctuated by these blanknesses. And in fact, it may be the universe itself is not continuous. Physicists tell me that's absolutely how they see it, you know. But at any rate, if we are in deep concentration, we experience consciousness as discontinuous. Now, the interesting thing about this is that when you're in the moment 100%, everything is very fresh each time. Each time. I've talked a little about this before, but, you know, a moment is actually like a wave. If you're in deep concentration, you'll notice that each moment is like a wave. It has a wave-like structure. You know, it starts, and it, there's the beginning of the moment, and then it begins to get a little, you begin to think. And then you usually have an emotion. So every moment starts with like pure experience, a pure perception, or a pure awareness. So pure awareness, thought, emotion, blank. See, and then on to the next moment. Pure awareness, thought, thinking, emotion, next moment. This is the structure of the moment, actually, you know. So you're watching them. If you watch the breath, you watch the breath for a little while. At first, you're just aware of the breath, and then you start thinking, and then you might have some kind of emotion. Then you come back to the breath. This is a natural. This is the natural structure of our awareness. So every moment of awareness is actually like a wave. At the beginning, there's a pure experience. And what we're doing when we do zazen, when we meditate, is to focus our attention on the front of the moment, on the beginning of each moment. So if you bring your, if you watch the breath and you focus and become one with the breath, there's a period there where there's no thought, just pure experience. Then you're going to inevitably have some kind of thought. And when you have some kind of thought, there will probably be some kind of an emotional element to that. And then you're on to the next moment. So the structure of our experience of the world is really moment-by-moment awareness. And the structure of the moment is like a wave. Okay. So if you keep practicing, you'll see this very clearly. And we keep, our method in Zen is to keep bringing ourselves back to what you could call the front of the moment, the first part of the moment. You know, the Buddha once said, "I am always at the beginning." And his followers didn't understand what he meant. He used to say, "I'm always at the beginning," and they think, "What does he mean? The beginning of what?" What he meant was, focus your mind on the beginning of each moment before thought arises, see? So our method is to focus on the breath and try to fuse with the breath before thought arises. And we keep bringing the mind back to the front of each moment, back to the beginning. Every moment for us is a fresh beginning. Now, you know, they have done studies, brain studies, of people who meditate. And actually, different meditation traditions produce different mental responses. So there are, in the Hindu tradition, people who meditate, and when they meditate, their brains don't register any response at all. Isn't that interesting? So they actually go into a deep trance, and the scientists put their hands in like a jar of ice water and measure responses in their nervous system, and it doesn't respond. It's like they're not getting the signals. But that's that particular way of meditating. But with Zen people, when they wire up their brains to see what happens, they experience, when they're in deep samadhi, they experience every moment as fresh. So normally, people have what's called a damping mechanism, I'm told. So, you know, if you do this, and then you do this, after a while, your brain stops paying attention to the sound of the bell. You know, it's a little hard to ignore right now, but if it's a stimulus, after a while, you just push it away. You stop noticing. But when they've measured brain processes of Zen people, you know, every moment registers by the brain as a fresh, registers in the brain as a fresh experience. Now, this is really very important. This might just seem trivial, but it's really quite important. Because really, every moment is a fresh start. You know, every moment is a fresh beginning. Now, I've been talking about meditation, but, many people in the Buddhist world believe, and I myself believe, that the world itself is not continuous. That we live in each moment is like a new life. It's like a new life. This sounds crazy, I know. But you know, physicists say this too. I was so shocked to read this, and there's a person who sits with us who is a physicist. And he agreed completely. He said, yes, that's what we believe. You know, he says the universe is oscillating. It's pulsating all the time. It's like here and not here, here and not here. We experience it as continuous, but he said that's not what physicists think is really happening. Well, you can take that with a giant grain of salt. Please do. But there have been great Buddhist philosophers, like the great Dharmakirti, who was really one of the greatest Buddhist logicians and philosophers, who really took seriously the idea that every moment is a new moment. It's really totally, the universe starts all over again with every moment. Now, you know, you could take that as a psychological fact, or you could take it as a fact of reality, or physics, or whatever you like, but in Zen, it is possible for people to experience every moment as a fresh beginning. As a fresh beginning. You know, and this is so important psychologically, right? Because we get so trapped in the way we live. We become so trapped in our mental habits and our loops and our psychological baggage. At times it can seem like there's no way out. But you know, it's possible to start again in every moment. That's really the teaching. And you know, sometimes you can come into the room and sit down on the cushion and you can feel so trapped. And you bring your mind back to the present moment, back to the present moment, and suddenly, you know, you realize that there's this tremendous openness all around us all the time. This possibility all the time, openness all the time. You know, it really is possible to start again all the time. We're not prisoners of these scripts that we carry around in our heads. You know, there's another dimension to this this whole teaching also. You know, people don't normally think of Buddhism this way, but you know, Buddhism is really really committed to a kind of like radical equality. Radical equality. You know, every moment is equal to every other moment. Every moment is 100% the universe, if I can put it that way. You know, so it may be true that when I'm shining my shoes, in a certain sense, that's not as important as when I'm doing something for Rutgers, let's say. You know, you can say, well, that's a Rutgers report. That's more important than shining my shoes, or that's more important than cutting the grass. See, that is not a Zen view. That's actually not a Buddhist view. You know, every moment is 100% the universe, you know? So whether you're cutting the grass or you're writing a report for the President of the United States, you know, it, from the Zen standpoint, it's actually an illusion to think that one is more important than the other. You know, and you say, oh no, one is it. The president's more important than the grass. But actually, that actually leads to a lot of sadness. A lot of sadness. Because we always feel we're not having the most important moment we should be having. All my moments should be presidential moments, see? Not grass-cutting moments. See, we often feel like we're in the wrong moment. It's not important enough. It's not worthy enough. And we're not worthy enough. See, So I should get the grass over right away so I can have some important moments. See, this is, from a Zen standpoint, this is a very unhealthy set of mental habits. Every moment is the universe 100%. So be here now. It's 100% universe. This moment is as important as any moment that has ever happened, and as any moment that will ever be. Even if it's not creating a report for the president, see? So as humans, we create hierarchy. We create, we say, this is more important than this. This is not the Buddhist view. Everything is, there's a kind of radical equality. Every moment is equal to every other moment. See, this is, you know, this is very, very important. You know, I am not a better person than I was 20 years ago. From a relative standpoint, that may be true. You know, 50 years ago, you know, I didn't have a PhD, I didn't have a job, I didn't know anything. You know, I was reading Superman comic books or something. My highest aspiration was to get a popsicle when the popsicle truck came by in our apartment in Baltimore. I would think about it all day long. That was my intellectual life, waiting for the popsicle man. So you can say, oh, I'm better now. You know, I read philosophy, I do develop. But that's not a Zen view. Every moment is 100% universe. So, you know, actually, when we meditate, we're not trying to become better people. We're not. That is a samsaric view. We're not trying to improve ourselves. What we're trying to do is be 100% present with this moment. See, this is very important. Because you're never, you know, if you're trying to be a better person than you were a few minutes ago, you're never going to be good enough. That absolutely makes this moment empty and valueless. Because you're never there. You know, we Americans live for the future. Ronald Reagan said this is the only country that lives in the future. And he's right. In my view, though, that's not a healthy way to live. I would like to live in a society where everybody lived in the moment, you know, like as fully as possible. Because, you know, the thing about the future is it never arrives. It always keeps receding, so you're never there. My life right now is meaningless, but when I get to that point in the future, it will have meaning. That point never arrives, right? So, you know, the point at which your life has value and meaning just keeps receding infinitely into the distance. You know, and events happen to us that are supposed to be wonderful events, and when they happen, we realize they're really rather hollow. You know, so, I mean, I worked very hard to get my PhD, and, you know, the day I got my PhD, it was like nothing. It's like, yeah. And it wasn't that I had it, you know. It was that it wasn't really much of an experience. You know, it wasn't like when they handed me a piece of paper, I suddenly felt 4 feet off the ground, you know. Around the time I got my PhD, the experience I remember as being the best experience was my wife and I went to a campground on the Rio Grande River, and we camped out, and it was my birthday. And I went to a Mexican restaurant and had some of the best Mexican food I've ever had. And we ate at the restaurant, and then we went back and we sat in our tent and looked at the moon. And that was a much better experience than getting my PhD. You know. Probably because we were there 100%. So you know, this idea of being in the moment is very, very important. Now, our lives are poisoned by not being in the moment. By wanting to be in some other moment and thinking that there's some other moment that's better than this moment. This is like the fundamental disease of human beings. You know. So, you know, basically, if you think, oh my God, you know, if only I were in that moment I'd be happy. You know, that moment will come someday. And, you know, that's a mental illness from the Zen standpoint. You know, the road to happiness and health is to be present 100% right now. And when you do that, it becomes so wonderful. I myself have to meditate. You know, I have to get on the cushion. I too can be unhappy because I don't like the moment that I have. And, you know, I have to take my medicine too. I sit down on the cushion and I suddenly feel like, oh my God, I am so happy to be alive. See? So it's not necessarily human nature to be 100% in the moment, because we have these powerful imaginations and we have a culture which constantly tells us that the future is where our realization lies. You know, a culture is constantly saying, look ahead, what here now doesn't matter, it's the future that matters. You know, so we get a very bad message from our culture. When you're here 100%, you know, everything opens up. There's this wonderful sense of being alive, and great, enormous gratitude becomes self-evident. You know, how wonderful to be here now. And you know, as I say, this is really a teaching of like equality. Every moment is equal to every other moment. You aren't a better person than you were 10 years ago. You know, I was 100% present. The night I sat in my tent and looked at the moon after eating an excellent Mexican meal in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I can't really say that right now my life is better or worse. Every moment is its own universe, 100%. One other thing, you know, when I, you know, this teaching is very important. You know, if you look back on your past self with contempt, or if you think your past self was not as good as you are now, that actually means that you look that way probably on other people as well, you know? So, I don't know if I'm making any sense, but if we have contempt for who we were, we probably have a lot of contempt for who we are. And we probably have a lot of contempt for other people too, you know. So you know, we're encouraged to think about ourselves as getting better and better, better and better. But this, I think, is really a fundamentally uncompassionate way of thinking about anything. You know, every moment is 100% the universe, you know. You aren't better than you were when you were 6. You aren't better than you were yesterday. And you won't be better than you are now 6 months from now. If you're 100% in this moment, that's perfection. That's perfection. Every moment is its own perfection. Okay. Who wants particle after particle samadhi? Transcending all ranks, rising above all expedience, spirit corresponding to spirit, words answering words, unless he has undergone the great emancipation and attained the great use of it, how could he rank with the Buddhas and be a faultless exponent of the teachings? Now tell me, who can be so direct and adaptable to all occasions and have the free command of transcendent words? See the following. A monk asked Master Cloudgate, what is particle after particle samadhi? Ulmon said, rice in your bowl, water in a pail. So whatever is, which is more important, see, you know, the President of the United States or rice in your bowl? Writing War and Peace or writing rice in your bowl? Depends on your moment, right? If your moment right now is rice in a bowl, that's as important as anything in the universe. Be present with that rice. Be present with that water. Okay. Secho's verse, rice in the bowl, water in the pail. Even the most talkative can add nothing to that perfection. The north and the south stars do not change places. heaven-touching waves arise on land. If you doubt, if you hesitate, if you aren't in the moment, even if you're heir to millions of dollars, you can't even afford a pair of pants.